is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
We're going to get good players, but our league's going to get great players. So we have to try and outskill and out-knowledge people.
Dan Priest is entering his 12th year as the head men's basketball coach at Kenyon College in Gambier, Ohio. Priest was named NCAC Coach of the Year in 2013, and he has had 14 players named to the all-NCAC teams during his tenure at Kenyon. Prior to coming to Kenyon College, he spent 7 seasons as the head coach at Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas, where he inherited an 0-23 team and within 3 years had led the Warriors to a 15-10 mark. Prior to his 6 seasons at Hendricks, Priest spent 5 years as the head coach at Ohio Dominican University in Columbus, Ohio. Priest's past coaching experiences also include 7 years as an assistant at Hanover College and brief stints as a graduate assistant at both Indiana State University and Miami of Ohio. As a player, Priest was a 3-year letterman at Ohio Northern University and helped lead the Polar Bears to the NCAA tournament in 1988. He still holds the university's career 3-point field goal percentage record at 48.6%. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Nick Legalbo, head boys basketball coach at Lane Tech High School in Chicago, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly. Mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Dan Priest, head men's basketball coach at Kenyon College. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the Hoopheads pod, Dan Priest, the head men's basketball coach at Kenyon College in Gambier, Ohio. Dan, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Mike. I appreciate it.
Excited to have you on. Want to dig into all the things that you've been able to do in your life as a basketball player, a basketball coach. Let's go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the game, what some of your first experiences that you remember with the game of basketball were.
Yeah, sure. So I spent my entire life, actually almost every day of my life, either working or living on a college campus because I was born and raised in Oxford, Ohio. My dad was a professor of physics at Miami. So that's I've never not been on a college campus. So I just kind of grew up just hooping. At that time, the rec centers were open. You could just go and play and hoop. And that was kind of what got me going. I just was always around basketball at Miami. And that was in my generation, it was before the before the AAU scene kind of got on, and honestly before the high school team leagues and summer leagues and all that. So it just, you were just kind of going and playing pickup basketball. So that's how it all started for me, and being on the college campus and being around Miami, and being it was actually a really great experience and a great opportunity at that time. You could go play any afternoon, any evening, and go get games. And Miami was a place that had, you know, really good players that weren't playing in college that chose Miami just because of it was Miami. So good competition level. And that's what kind of got me going into it, and being able to be around Miami. And when I grew up, it was Ron Harper and Randy Ayers and those guys. So seeing really good college basketball. And that's what kind of got me going, and got me to be kind of a gym rat and a hoopaholic.
When did you realize that you kind of had a good situation, that maybe other kids that you went to school with didn't have that same access to gyms? When did that realization strike you?
Yeah, probably not too much when I got to college a little bit, maybe even afterward. And I was kind of like, well, what do you mean you couldn't just go do this? And I mean, I literally, you know, if you've ever been to Oxford, Ohio, it's about 4 square miles, 5 square miles. But, you know, when the students are there, 30,000 people. So literally, you know, again, it was a different day and time and day and age. But I would ride my bike down to after I ate dinner, and ride my bike down to campus. And mom and dad didn't think anything of it. And after school, I would either, you know, walk or ride my bike or whatever, just down to campus. And I just thought that was kind of normal. And, you know, Cincinnati was 35 minutes, 40 minutes away, but it was almost like another universe. You just didn't go there. It wasn't what you did, and you didn't have any need to. So I think when I got to college and saw like some of my college teammates at Ohio Northern, that this was a little bit different, because I had teammates that were from the city or really small farm towns. So I think it was probably that. But I think honestly, over the time of the past 25 or 30 years, it's probably become even more and more of a realization. And it's interesting. I have three kids, particularly my two sons, they're always kind of amazed at kind of what a cool thing that was, and that you just go hoop whenever you wanted. And again, at that time, you didn't have to show your ID to get into the rec centers, or if you did, you could fake it pretty easy. So it was a lot easier and a lot simpler.
There's no question about that. I grew up in that same era as you, and I tell people all the time that the ability to just go out and play basketball and be able to, I used to ride my bike to the local rec park. That's how it started when I was probably 13 or 14 years old, playing with high school kids, college kids, adults. And I really feel like that helped me to develop as a player. And obviously the system today, as you referenced, is a lot different. This is kind of a point of conversation that we've had many times on the podcast, but I'm just curious to get your perspective on it. When you think about the system that you grew up in, which really wasn't a system, but it was just an opportunity to go and play, versus how the kids that you coach today grow up in the game with AAU basketball, with trainers, with travel basketball, playing with kids in their own grade level from the time they're second or third grade. How in your mind do you compare and contrast the two when you think about how it develops players? Do you have a thought about which one? I don't know if I want to say which one's better, but just, and when you're looking at them, how do you kind of analyze the way you grew up versus the way kids are growing up in the game today?
Certainly different. And I would guess that you have a lot of these discussions on your podcast, and people have a lot of opinions about it. I'm not anti-trainers or anti-AAUs. I can only speak from my standpoint. And as you're saying, just like riding your bike to the park, we played a lot of just 2-on-2 and 3-on-3 at the park. And then, you know, we'd go to the local pool for an hour or two, and then come back and hoop some more. So I think that part of just kind of figuring out how to play without anyone telling you what your position was or what play you were supposed to run or the lack of structure, I think there's a lot of benefit to that. And I think there's some benefit to the trainers and the AAU scene too, but I think there's a lot of benefit to that of just learning how to play without anyone telling you what you're supposed to do, or where you're supposed to cut, or where you're supposed to screen, or who you're supposed to guard, or that you're supposed to be the point guard, or the two, or the five, or whatever. So I do think there's a lot of benefit to that. And for us in Division III, you know, we just have limited contact with them outside the season. So we have to kind of retrain them once they get here to go do those things, because they're so used to have everything structured for them, either high school team league, team camp, AU, trainers, whatever, that now they don't have any of that. So it's a real challenge for us to get them to say, hey, you got to go to teach them how to work out on their own, or teach them to go find some guys. And right. Like, it's okay. Just get five dudes and play some 3-on-3 and figure some stuff out. It's a foreign concept to them. So there's probably some plus and minus to both, but I certainly think there's a lot of benefit for how things were when I was 15, 16, 17.
What do those conversations with your guys sound like when you're talking to them about, hey, okay, we can't have any contact, here's some of the things that you should do? What do those conversations look like? What exactly are you telling them? And what are you hoping happens? Obviously, you hope your upperclassmen, your leaders, kind of take control of it and get them in the gym and do the things that they need to do. But what kind of conversations do you have with them?
Yeah, well, most of it's how to work out at a game speed and a game situation. They just don't understand that, because they've always had someone passing for them and setting the cones up for them and telling them what drill they're going to do. So first, just the pace at which they have to try and work out, the pace at which they have to get shots up, and the game-like situations. That's like the first thing we're really talking to them about. And then making things as competitive as possible is what we have to talk to them about. Because, again, when I was growing up, if you lost, you didn't get to play anymore. You
know, that's, right, exactly. That's a pretty good motivator.
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, AU, you're going to play at 10, 2, and 5 no matter what. It was you lost, and then you also had to figure out, like, how do you get into the next game? It wasn't, you know, you have to go find who's got the next game and barter and argue a little bit and get on somebody's team and prove yourself. So so the game speed of things, the actual production when they're working out, how to play, just pick up basketball and making it as competitive as possible. Those are the real conversations. And then in Division III, it just comes down to the guys that's kind of the value of Division III. How much are they going to work at it on their own? And for our guys, it's balancing that with internships or jobs to make money to pay for school, or, you know, some really cool work experience that they have, of balancing that with getting the workout situation in also.
From your coaching perspective, and obviously you've been at it a long time at this level, when you think about the time that you spend away from your guys and the trust, what you have to put in their hands in order to get them to develop, how does that impact the type of guys that you want to bring into your program and the type of recruiting that you do? In other words, when you're looking, what kind of intangibles are you looking for when you recruit a player that maybe would lead you to believe that they're going to be the type of kid that's going to put in the hours necessary to continue to improve and get better over the course of their career?
Yeah, it's really hard. You have to find someone that it's really important to. And sometimes we've done a good job. Sometimes, honestly, we've done a bad job of it. And that doesn't mean that their academic situation isn't the number one important thing to them. It has to be, else they're not going to make it for us or probably most places. And it doesn't mean that they can't have other things, or that their family situation has to be incredibly important to them and their relationships. But you just have to try and use your gut and instinct of who is it really important to, and what are their priorities, and who does this really matter to? Because if it doesn't, then the NCAA rules are, they're not good, honestly, for us. And I'm on the NCAA board, and we've been pounding the drum and fighting it. Not just the standpoint of us, it's not just the workout part outside of season, but just the contact with the guys, the retention part of trying to form relationships with them, and just the contact with them is, from a personal and academic level, is hard. And from a basketball standpoint, if we just had, you know, we don't have any contact with them until October 15th. If we just had, you know, 2-3 hours a week, it would be a big plus. But just trying to get a sense what's important to their families, and what's important to them, and kind of how driven they are to do things on their own. There's no perfect equation for it, for sure.
That makes a lot of sense. When you think about what you'd like the ideal situation to be. So if you could draft up, okay, here's going to be the new rules off season for Division III of what can happen, what would that look like to you? And I know, like, I think about as a Division I player, now the amount of time that those guys have to spend.
Yeah, too much, maybe.
Yeah, too much. I agree with you 100%. I mean, I think about when I was playing at Kent and, you know, at the end of my season, I got handed a 3-page ditto that go, hey, here's your workout.
Yep.
You know, we'll see you back here when school starts up again in September. And, you know, obviously, you know, you have workouts and you have conditioning and all that stuff. But now, basically, those kids are on campus pretty much 50 weeks out of the year.
Sure.
You know, they get a couple weeks off. And I feel like personally that not only from a player standpoint, but I would think as a coach, like, you need a break. Like, you have to get away from each other and get that break. So there's got to be a happy medium in there between no contact and almost too much contact. So in your mind, if you could wave that magic wand and just make it look what in your mind would be an ideal fit for your situation, what would that look like?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I just went and watched Ohio State practice this afternoon, and it's awesome. Those Chris Holtman, Ryan Pate, they're tremendous and doing a great job. But this is their, I don't know, fifth, sixth, seventh practice, and it looks to me like they're mid-January.
and they've
just by where they are in terms of what they're doing. And I think some of that is good, and some of it, you know, as you say, there might be a point of diminishing returns. So I think for us, I think what would be beneficial, last year, actually, during COVID, we were able to just, you know, we didn't play any games, so it was a little bit different. But even the people that did, you took the same amount of practices and just spread them out over a longer period. So you could start October 1st, and you could go like 3 or 4 weeks after the season. That, if I could wave my magic wand, would be a huge benefit, because then you don't have to feel like you're jamming six practices in a week. You get some contact with them outside of, you know, the basketball part is good, but you get a little part to say, how's it going? How's your roommate doing? How are you homesick? How's class? How's biology class? Whatever. So I think that part of being able to, you know, the same amount of practice, but being able to spread them out would be better physically and mentally on them. And I think, you know, when they got here, if we could, again, even a couple hours a week just to work on skill stuff, if small groups, 3-4 kids, whatever time, even if it's no live contact, if you could have 2 hours per kid, because they're going to be doing it anyway, the kids that really want to be good, and the kids that are going to compete in Division III, they're going to do it anyway. So in my mind, it would be better if it's supervised and structured, that they do more in 2 hours than they would in 4 hours on their own. And then, you know, after the season, just even a couple hours, just more so that to just know how they're doing and have a little bit of contact with them. So that's what, if, you know, I'm on the NABC board, and if we could, I think that would be what we'll keep pushing for. I don't know if we'll ever get there, but same amount of practice, spread them out a little bit more, and then, you know, a couple hours outside of, and then in the summer, they're going and doing their thing.
What do you put the odds at that something like that ever happens in some form?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I was just on a call, and one of the coaches said, you know, it took a global pandemic for us to even get this considered. And we had some coaches say, well, it's just, that's kind of a play by ear and wait and see how it goes here. And the coach is like, you guys are nuts. Like, it took a global pandemic for us to even get this for a year. Like, we need to strike while it's hot. So, I don't have high hopes for the out-of-season stuff as much as I would. I do think that there is a little bit of momentum possibly for us being able to start a little bit early and spread them out just from, you know, I start practice October 15th. We scrimmage on the 28th. We play on November 10th. So you don't have a choice but to max out and go 6 days a week. And if you've got facility restrictions, you got to do it whenever you get in there, whether that's 8 at night, 6 a.m., Saturday, Sunday. So I think there is some momentum for, hey, if we could spread it out, it would be better for the student athletes' overall well-being, that we wouldn't have to have, you know, kind of crazier practice times and practice in 6-7 days in a row. It'd be better for the training staff, that kind of deal. So I think there's some momentum possibility for that. The out-of-season workouts, I don't know. We've been banging the drum for a while, haven't got there. So I know I'm not as optimistic about that.
It's amazing when you think about how it doesn't just impact you and your staff, or a staff and the players, when you start thinking about, you don't always consider the training staff, you don't always consider whatever academic advisors, you don't always consider the fact that, hey, the facilities may have other things. There's other teams that need to get in the gym and utilize that gym time. And not every school has the same access to facilities. And so now you're talking about, again, a kid who, if you got to go practice at 8:30 at night, maybe that's the time the kid normally is studying. And so there's all those impacts that I think sometimes on the outside looking in that we don't always think about. Clearly, if you watch a game, you're talking about a Division I game, you watch it on TV and you see the kids, and you don't always process all the things that go on behind the scenes. I think that's one of the things that the general public really doesn't have a great understanding of Division I athletics, and they certainly don't have any understanding of Division III athletics. The number of coaches we've talked to, I'm sure, Dan, you've had the same conversation with kids who you're recruiting them, you're talking to them, and a lot of them have probably never even seen a Division III game before they set foot on your campus or before you start recruiting them. And to me, that's always quite interesting, especially here in the state of Ohio, like we talked about before we jumped on, that there's so many Division III schools here in the state of Ohio. The fact that you have kids playing high school basketball that have never seen a Division III game is kind of, you know, it's kind of amazing when you really think about it, with the sheer number of schools that are playing Division III basketball in the state of Ohio.
Yep, it is. The retention is an issue too. I don't know as much for us, but you know, a head coach could have very, very limited contact with a kid for the first 6-7 weeks of school, when he's been their primary source of contact with the family and with the kid. And as you know, the first 6 weeks of college acclimation is challenging academically, socially, homesick, just a lot of things living on your own. That I think there's a lot of validity to that. If coaches could have some contact with them, it would, because Division III schools don't want kids transferring. It's a financial issue a little bit too, that the retention factor
for sure. Absolutely.
But you're right about the Division III games. I think if more kids could go see Division III and Division II games, it'd be real eye openers for them.
The level of play, when you talk to parents or kids who maybe don't have that much experience in the recruiting and they're not really sure what they're doing, and obviously there's a huge Division I or bust mentality that's out there, and I'm sure that does something that you, along with many of other Division III coaches that we've talked to, are fighting that all the time. And one of the things that we've tried to do on here, Dan, is talk to our audience and just say, look, Division III basketball is way better than you think it is. Just go and play some pickup basketball with some Division III college basketball players, and you'll find out real quick as a high school player, you know, how high of a level of basketball that is. And that's one of the things that we've really tried to hammer home here on the podcast. And I think it's just amazing to me, like I said, that kids don't see any games who have aspirations of playing college basketball at any level. It's always amazing to me. So thinking back in time for you, as you're growing up and you're playing the game and eventually you get an opportunity to go and play at Ohio Northern, give me a highlight of your college career, something that you remember that sticks with you, that, you know, maybe again, when you think about what your kids are going to remember that you're coaching now, but just something that sticks out for you as a player.
Yeah. So my first year, I was hurt the whole year. I had that surgery on my wrist, and I wouldn't have been good enough to play as a freshman anyway. So it was probably a little bit of a blessing, but I couldn't play. And it took me time to get me, you know, at that time you had JV teams. I'd played a little bit of JV basketball as a sophomore to get back. So like one thing that sticks out to me is the lesson of perseverance and stick-to-itiveness and of battling through tough times. I think that's what probably Division III basketball, or at least my basketball, college basketball experience. And I played for a really tough guy in Gil Doherty. So that was required some perseverance in itself. So that's one thing that really sticks out to me, is that lesson and what I try to always convey to our guys that we're teaching them about, you know, you don't get the first job you apply for, or you don't get promoted all the time, or things don't go your way. So that part, and then just the relationships that you form. There was, you know, five guys that I lived with or played with that I, you know, still talk to them almost every week. You know, two of them have called me this week, and all We're going up to Ohio Northern scrimmage. I'll have four or five of them. We'll come up just to say hello. But, you know, guys are at my weddings, my dad's funeral, those kind of things. So those are the two things that really stick out to me as much, the lessons of perseverance and of not giving up, and then the relationships that you form that are kind of formed inside basketball, but formed really with just because of what you're going through.
Absolutely. Those are two great lessons. I think the perseverance piece, especially all you got to do is look at the transfer portal.
For sure.
Understand that perseverance isn't necessarily something that a lot of people are espousing these days.
Absolutely.
There's not a lot of kids who go into school as freshmen with maybe a realistic vision of what they should or shouldn't be able to do. And I think consequently, you have a lot of kids that make decisions that aren't the right one, that aren't the right fit for who they are. And I think that's a big piece of, for parents, for kids, for coaches, is trying to make sure that they figure out what's the right fit for this player, whether, again, doesn't matter the level, trying to find the right level, trying to find the right school academically, the right fit with the program. It's so, so important. And too often you see, hey, it doesn't work out for me in the first half of my freshman season, and
yep,
I'm jumping ship and going somewhere else. And I think that perseverance piece is something that, as coaches, the more we can espouse that message, I think the better off we are, without question. And obviously the relationships that you built with your teammates, and that's the kind of thing that I think, as coaches, if there's anything more gratifying than building that relationship as a coach with your player, but then also seeing your players bond as teammates and eventually friends and people that, again, now you're 30 years removed from being a college basketball player and you're still in connection with your college teammates. So that's something that, you know, that's something that's really fun. I actually went back, Jason, I don't even think I told you this story, but I went back to Kent this weekend and I walked. I've been back to games. I try to go back to at least one game a year, but I went back this time with my family and walked the campus. And I haven't walked the campus in, I don't think I've walked it since I left. And there was a hill that we used to run up on campus. And so my son, who's a sophomore in high school, he and I ran the hill, and I sent it to one of my teammates. I'm like, hey man, you remember this? And then of course then that just sets off a avalanche of, you know, texting back and forth of, yeah, next time you got to go out to the stadium and do the agilities and jump in and out of these big giant tires on asphalt like we used to do, and all this crazy stuff. And so those are the kinds of things that obviously you treasure and that you hope that you can build for your kids that you're coaching when you eventually get into the position where, you know, you've been fortunate enough to get to. When you think back to your decision to become a coach, was it something that you always knew you wanted to do, or did it come to you when your playing career ended, you kind of looked around and you're like, okay, now I got to figure out a way to stay in the game? Were you somebody that always thought about being a coach, or was it something that came to you at the end?
Yeah, I think I did. Again, growing up at around Miami, that was, I kind of always had it in my brain a little bit. I say this kind of jokingly, but seriously, my brother was a bit of an influence on me. He became a high school teacher, wanted to be a high school basketball coach and teach math, and he kind of pushed me along that track, and he's 7 years older than me, but he did it for about 4 or 5 years and then decided he was going to go make a lot more money and work about a third as much as I do. And that's worked out for him. I can call him about any time of the day. He seems to answer. He doesn't have to, he's got a lot of time and a lot of money. So he got out and I kept following it. So I honestly think that was kind of part of it, but I think I knew that's kind of what I want to do. And again, I was fortunate to play for a really good college coach in Gale Doherty. So that was my thought. And I always kind of thought I could maybe go back to Miami and get a GA. And it was fortunate that's how it worked out for me.
So when you first take that GA job and you kind of go behind the curtain with the coaching staff, what did that look like? What do you remember? What was surprising to you? Was there anything that you were like, oh man, I didn't realize coaches were spending that much time working on that particular task? Or just what were your initial impressions?
Yeah, well, I got a real kind of baptism to Division I basketball. So I got hired by Jerry Pearson, who I had known, kind of was a neighbor of ours forever. But Coach Pearson hired me, and he got fired in the summer. It was a long story issue. But so I hadn't even worked a day, and basically we were fired. So that was, I'm like, wow, this is great.
Welcome to coaching, right?
Yeah, there awesome, right? And then so I Joby Wright, Bob Knight assistant, got the job. He kept me on for a year, and that was his first year. And, you know, all of us got fired two or three times during that year. And then, you know, at the end of the year, he kind of wanted his own guys, and which I understood. And I was just going to stay at Miami and be a finish my master's degree and work in intramural and rec sports. And I got lucky that Tate's Lock hired me at Indiana State. But that was my first impression. I was like, wow, this is a crazy world. And I was living in my hometown, which was kind of good and bad. So the real thing for me came when I was able to go to Indiana State. And again, Tate's Lock, who was the head coach at Army, and when Bob Knight was his assistant coach, the only person that Knight ever worked for as an assistant coach. And Coach Lock's story has gone round and round. But that's when I kind of really found out, like, this is what coaching is all about. This is the time. This is kind of how it's done. And this is what you have to put in. Is when I went to Terre Haute, because I literally just drove over there, interviewed, and he hired me that day. And, you know, I had all my stuff in the car. And, you know, at that time, you're making $3,000 or $4,000, and just kind of learned how to survive. So it was a really interesting 2 years for me.
Absolutely. Jason and I had the good fortune, now what's 3 summers ago, so not this summer, not the summer before because it was COVID, but the summer before out at Snow Valley to meet Tate's out there and get a chance to actually sit down and talk to him and watch him demonstrate and do some clinics with the kids. It was just, again, a guy that you can just tell, like, basketball lifer. Yep. Guy has probably more knowledge of the game of basketball than, you know, I'll ever be able to, you know, yep, be able to get into my own brain. And took the time, I know, at least once or twice, sat down at a meal with them and had some conversations, and just, again, pouring knowledge into all the coaches that were there and the kids and the campers that were a part of it. And so, an incredible guy, I'm sure. A great way to start out your coaching career is to be able to learn and work, yeah, and observe and watch what he did as the head coach there at Indiana State. Did you always know that, since your brother was talking about doing the high school and, you know, teaching route, did you always know you wanted to go the college route simply because of, you know,
I thought so if I could. I think, again, just because I thought maybe I could get a GA doing it. I got a math ed degree, so, and I think that's probably why I did the math thing, because at least at that time that was higher demand in terms of high school coach. But right, I think I always thought that I wanted to do that. You know, again, after that first year at Miami, and my head was spinning a little bit, so it wasn't really sure what I was getting into. And as a young person, you probably get influenced by the whole Division I or lower a little bit. Meanwhile, I was at Miami, we played at Nebraska, we played at Purdue, as Indiana State, we played at IU, and those things kind of wow you a little bit and can probably jade your perspective of playing big crowds and, you know, flying on the airplane, doing all that.
Sure.
Now, at that time, the money wasn't what it is now, I think, and I think that probably jades guys even more, that they're staying at the Division I level because they're the potential.
Don't know, right, what's potential payoff.
Potential, right, paycheck is, even for the assistant level, you know, if they're latching on to the right guy. So, I think that gets in your brain. So, but I did think that the college thing was what I wanted to do. When I got to Indiana State, I had to kind of make a call, interview some few Division I jobs and few Division III assistant jobs. And I think it led me to the right path. But I thought that was probably always what I wanted to do.
All right. How does the opportunity at Hanover come across your table?
Yeah. So when I got hired at Indiana State, it was, you know, he had some connection with Mike Beitzel, the coach at Hanover. But ironically, when I got hired at Indiana State, it was just a friend of a friend of mine whose dad had been roommates with Coach Lock, and just happened to bump into him. And he convinced me to talk to him. And at that time, Thad Mata had just left Indiana State to go to Butler as a GA. So it was 3 or 4 days before. So I just walked in the house, met Coach Locke, and he said, "Oh, you need a job?" And on, offer you a job. And that's how that all came about. And then when I got done, at that time was when the restricted earnings situation was happening in Division I, where you could only have so many people on staff and you could only, yep, have 3 instead of 4. And so I was kind of, I could have stayed around Indiana State, but I was kind of out. And the Hanover thing came up a little bit. I just applied, and my boss at Hanover, Mike Beisel, again, was pretty hard-nosed guy, but I think he knew I played for Gil Doherty, who again was a really, really tough guy and really demanding guy. And Coach Locke, of course, was incredibly demanding. So I think he kind of looked at me and thought if I could survive those guys, I could survive him. And having a Division III background, I think was certainly a factor. Having played it for Coach Doherty and having a little bit of the Division III background, I think helped me. But I did not know him. There's no connection that way with him. But it worked out.
So when you get that job, I'm assuming that compared to the duties that you had as a GA, that the amount of things that you now were asked to do or got to do, depending, I guess, on how you look at it, definitely increased. So what did those early years there as an assistant coach teach you? What did you learn that has helped you as you've moved on in your career?
Yeah, so it's the recruiting aspect, first and foremost. When I was at Indiana State in Miami, just by the rules, you're limited what you can do. And I just didn't have that much involvement. Where we're in Division III, you're the guy. And so just the amount of time pounding the phone and getting on the road and doing all that was the major thing. And then in Division III, you have to learn to, although not as much anymore, you have to learn to balance a little bit of other job descriptions, which I think some people complain about. But I think it's something that's kind of cool about Division III. My job description at Kenyon is great. I teach 1P class. I do some game management stuff. So it's very easy to do. And it's honestly, it's probably as much as when you played with the Division I assistants were at that time.
We're doing
some more. Not so much anymore. But at that time, at Hanover, I was the head women's tennis coach. I was the intramural director. You're doing those kind of things. So, you know, you learn how to balance that. But I don't mind doing a little bit of that stuff now. Keep you connected to campus and to students and the general student body. But that was a little bit of an issue where I got hired to be the assistant basketball coach. But those other things were important. So, you know, trying to put some time and effort into that. But the recruiting piece, just the grinding part of the recruiting and just the amount of time and what you have to do to find guys.
How long did it take you to get a feel for the type of player, both from a skill level, academics, fit? How long did it take for you to figure out what type of player you guys wanted to bring into the program at Hanover?
Yeah, not too long, honestly, because I think just because of my background. And again, I'd been in Division I for a couple years and good teams, but you know, I wasn't in the Big Ten or wasn't at a Power 5 place or anything. So I think I had a pretty good sense. And I got lucky when we got there. We had a freshman who ended up being the National Player of the Year. So that helped us just in terms of credibility in the state and getting some guys. So I don't think that the talent level thing was a big issue, but I was an Indiana guy and we recruit mostly Indiana schools. So just getting to know the state, and at that time was more the high school scene than the AAU scene. So that part took a little bit of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think trying to figure out and build those connections when it's not a place that you're from, where you don't have those connections coming in, I'm sure that does take some time to build those relationships so that coaches trust you and you trust them, and you know that when you go to them and ask for their opinion on a particular player, that you know you're getting the truth and you know which guys you can count on and which guys you can't. Yep. So when you think about that time, and obviously you're there for 7 years, so you get an opportunity to really dive into what it takes to be a good quality assistant coach. And as you're doing that, in the back of your mind, are you starting to prepare for a future head coaching opportunity in terms of, are you keeping a notebook? Are you starting to put together a three-ring binder of things that, hey, when I get my opportunity, this is what I'm going to do? Just what was your process for preparing for the next step of your career during that time?
Yeah, for sure. I don't think, you know, now everything's on the computer, and at that time you wrote stuff down. So I can remember even being at Indiana State, I still have it. I go every year, I kind of go back and look through it, and I go through some of the funny things that Coach Locke used to say, just make me laugh. I got those written down, some of the inappropriate things and the language that wasn't so great. But I just go through the X and O stuff, and the same thing. Yeah, I remember just writing stuff down every practice. And again, after about 3 or 4 years there, I interviewed for a couple of Division I assistant jobs, and it didn't work, which was probably, you know, the right thing for me. But I was just, you know, trying to form and trying to talk to as many other coaches. You know, at that time, Steve Alford was head coach at Manchester, was in our league when I was at Hanover. So just kind of seeing how he was doing things and Bill Finland was coach at DePaul, who's still at DePaul, but a really highly successful Division III guy, and kind of seeing how they recruited, kind of guys they went after, how they ran their team, those kind of things. And trying to, I remember going to Xavier and watching, I'd go a couple times a year to watch Skip Prosser at Xavier to see how, sit down with Skip and how did he do things, what was his approach, his philosophy, those kind of things. So trying to get ready for that day to come.
Are you tired of slipping and sliding on the court and sticky sheets just aren't giving you grip? Grip Spritz solves this problem without having to lick your hand to clean your shoes. Grip Spritz is used by countless AAU, high school and college programs, semi-pro teams, as well as NCAA athletes and G League players. Unlike other products, Grip Spritz has solutions for individual players, not just entire teams. We've used Grip Spritz at our Head Start basketball camps and players love it. To keep you and your team from slipping and sliding, visit gripspritz.net to learn more. Would you say that even today, like going to practice, you mentioned earlier that you had gone and watched Ohio State practice today. How valuable is that to you as a head coach today to be able to carve out some time in your schedule to go watch other coaches at any level? It could be watching a high school practice, yep, while you're recruiting, or watching a Division I practice, or getting in to see, maybe you get up and see the Cavs practice. Yep. Just what's the value in that for you as a head coach?
I think it's incredibly important, to be honest. And I think, unfortunately, here in Central Ohio, we have really good high school coaches. I think in the state of Ohio in general. But I learned a tremendous amount from those. And I got a couple former players that are coaching. So I love going to watch those guys. Ohio Dominican is where, obviously, I got my start. But I like going to watch them practice. I'm fortunate that Ohio State is close to here. I'm going to try, because we can't start to the 15th. I went and watched Davidson 2 years ago. I think I'm going to go watch Butler this next weekend. But I think it's incredibly important. And honestly, I say this, maybe it makes it sound like I'm a little bit old and curmudgeon, but I think there are some young head coaches that think they got it figured out already. And I remember talking with Wes Miller, who's now the coach at Cincinnati. But when I was working Billis's camp, and he was talking, he said there's two kinds of coaches: those that are humbled, and those that are about to be humbled. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty interesting way to put it. But you know, he said you're always going to keep. He became a head coach at age 29 in Division I at UNC Greensboro. But I just think you got to keep learning. When we think you got it all figured out, you don't. And those things are really, really important to me. You got to be confident in what you're doing and have faith in who you are and what you're doing. But if you think you're not going to keep learning. So those things are great for me. The Division I thing, sometimes it's hard. You know, watch Ohio State today. They got 8-10 managers. You know, just they just always don't have those resources, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They had Greg Oden there just protecting the rim, hanging out. That's we don't quite have that dude.
You could track a lot more during practice. Yes. Right? It'd be a lot yes, easier if you could just say, all right, you're tracking this, you're tracking, yeah, this, you're tracking this.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, again, having Greg Oden around the hoop to play a little defense at that.
Yeah, that always helps.
That simulates a little bit. But
he's maybe more effective than the broom that you hold up. Is,
yes,
that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. The guy sat next to me, I said, I can't get a broom big enough to do what he's doing. But so you have to kind of take that into. And I used to go, I always watched the Celts quite a bit. Brad Stevens, you know, Division III guy, recruited Brad at Hanover, and he ended up going to DePaul, but kind of still had a relationship with him. And his assistant was Michael Shrewsbury, who I recruited also and came to Hanover and played for me at Hanover, and now is the head coach at Penn State. So Brad and Michael let me in and watch kind of their training camp stuff then. It was just really, really awesome to see that.
What are some of the things that you try to look for? Like, are you trying to pick up an X's and O thing? Are you trying to pick up maybe some language, some verbiage that you can use, terminology? What are the things that you're looking for specifically?
Yeah, so for me, it's the terminology thing is, and I've kind of come to this conclusion that kids remember, you know, you give things silly names or tricky names or colors or whatever, they seem to remember that more so than if you say you're reading the ball screen or what have you. And practice structure really is for me. How do they structure things? How much time do they spend on 5-on-5? How much do they do 5-on-0? How much skill work do they do? How does practice flow? Because that's the thing that keeps me up at night is, you know, you got X amount of time, and how much are you breaking down, how much you're doing in small parts, how much you're doing in big parts, so that the structure and the practice flow, honestly, is what I look for as much, and just kind of the communication aspect of what they're doing.
How's that practice structure for you changed over time since you first became a head coach? Are you spending more time, skill development, less time? Just how have you broken it down? How's it different from when you started?
Yeah, I'm probably spending more time skill development because we have to. You know, we're going to get good players, but our league's going to get great players. So we have to try and outskill and out-knowledge people. So I think the skill development, just get more shots, and we can do some, but we're not going to be able to bring our guys in for an hour every morning and then two hours of practice. We can do it once in a while, and they're coming a lot on their own. So the shot and skill development, probably doing less. Again, my college coach was a really structured, disciplined guy, and we would break down stuff defensively, either one-on-one, two-on-two, shell, rebounding, post defense, knocking down flashes, close out everything for an hour and 10 minutes. And that's probably how I started. But I've got away from that a little bit just because of time and just because of how the game is played a little bit. So we're doing a little bit more whole part stuff and maybe a little bit less of the trying to pick three or four things of defensive breakdown. The ball screen thing obviously is incredibly important. Everybody in our league does it, and six to seven of them do it in heavy doses. So we have to guard that every day in practice in different ways or shapes or forms. So the skill development thing, though, I do think is still really important. But right or wrong, we're probably doing a little bit less of the this particular skill defensive breakdown than when I started.
I think the ball screen piece of college basketball and basketball in general, compared to, let's go back to the time when you played, the time when I played, and it was the Bob Knight motion offense, screens off the ball. I've said it a couple times on the pod that I can probably count the number of times that I had to defend a ball screen or use a ball screen as a guy who played like 38 minutes a game as a Division I
level.
It was
taboo.
It was like one time, maybe five times a season, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
It was frowned upon almost. Like, don't do it. It's not good.
Right. It's not like that's not real basketball. Yeah. And now it's clearly a huge part of the game. So when you're working on that with your players, both from an offensive and defensive standpoint, how do you break that down? Do you start two on two? Do you start on air? How do you break down how you want that to be defended? And how do you break down the reads when you put it into your offense so your ball handler and your screener can read their screen roll?
We did some of the ball screen continuity stuff, kind of the Butler stuff, like 4 or 5 years ago. And honestly, it was a mistake because we just didn't have dynamic enough guys. Yeah. We had one off the dribble, but we kind of fell in this trap. It was no different than we were playing. Everyone was running the flex, and then everyone was running motion, and then the swing or the Princeton. And so it was what was really vogue, and it was a mistake because it just did not fit our personnel. So we did it all then, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, and all the even 1-on-0 of the reads of pulling it back or trying to split them or what have you. So we try to get away from the random ball screen or the set ball screens as much now. It's just not good for us. We can do a little bit more in terms of the dribble handoffs and the random ball screen. So we'll break that down a little bit, but we spend more time, defensively starting in kind of this 2-on-2 or 2-on-0 and then to the 3-on-3 stuff. And then to get it out of the, the 4-on-4 or the 5-on-5. We are downing or icing ball screens because really no one else in our league does it. I'm not saying that's the only way to do it, but for us, it helps us because we have to be different. If we do things how everyone else does it, it's going to be a challenge for us because the talent level in our league is so high. So we started trying to keep the ball on one side, down and ice. And so we can do that a little bit out of a 3-on-3 concept. And that's kind of how we'll start doing it, because for a lot of kids, it's a whole new foreign concept to them. But we have to do it almost every day, because like five of the teams in our league are going to do some kind of ball screen continuity. And you've watched, when the shot clock goes down, everyone's going to come. Everyone comes screen the ball.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just amazing how the game has changed. I you can barely recognize it. I For always sure. think if I was to jump back in, as a player, what would that feel like to play in that kind of system? It just is a completely different game than the one that you or I played. It's completely, completely different. It doesn't look the same, and I'm sure as a player it wouldn't feel the same at all. All right, thinking back to the transition from assistant coach, you get the head coaching job at Ohio Dominican. What's the transition like from an assistant to a head coach? What did you feel? How did that work for you?
Yeah, so Ohio Dominican was NAI at the time, and the NAI probably gets a little bit of a bad rap. I think sometimes people just don't recognize it enough or doesn't get as much publicity. But for me, it was awesome. You can play more games, you have more practice time, and it was just a tremendous experience for me. So, you know, as a first-year head coach, you think you've got things all figured out, and you're probably a little more emotional and those kind of things. It's not as much analytical as probably you should be. But it was a great experience for me. I learned right away. I was the third coach in 3 years there. They had a head coach and an interim and then me. So I found out pretty quick that it wasn't just about what offense you're running, all this and that. That they hadn't had anyone that really cared about them for a while. So I figured that out pretty quick, that they just need someone that was going to be there, that was going to care about them, that was going to be invested, and someone they thought was going to be there because they'd had so much turnover. So I think that was probably my biggest learning curve right away of that. And just figuring out that talent matters and the roster matters, because we won 18 games the first year, and I think I kind of knew what I was doing, but not really. You know, we just kind of hollered at them and got them to play really hard and kept recruiting and won most of our games. So I think I found out pretty quick that the talent level and the roster matters. But that piece of figuring out what do the guys need, what is it that's been lacking? And because one, that they weren't well coached, they were the guys, two guys for me were really good coaches, but just the turnover piece had probably caused some distrust and some issues there in terms of that they didn't feel kind of wanted or cared about.
Yeah, that can be tough when you have that turnover of staff, and it happens more than once, especially in a short period of time. That can, I'm sure, mess with the player's head for sure, and give you an opportunity to come in and try to rebuild that trust. When you think back to that time, what's something that you feel like you're a lot better at today than, and I'm sure you can say everything, but what's something that stands out to you that you're a lot better at today than you were when you first got that head coaching job?
Yeah. So I think when I got my first head coaching job, again, high energy, and maybe that's why they, you know, hired a young person like me, which is great. But, you know, trying to, you know, keep your emotions in trying to be highly emotional and high energy, but keeping your emotions at a level that keeps you focused and concentrated on either what's going on in practice or what's going on in the game. So I think that's probably what I look back, and I hope that learning curve has helped me a little bit. And the piece of that, you know, getting to know your players, and I think I did it then, but just the importance of every kid's different. And I've been at three different schools that are all very, very different places. So getting to know what makes each kid tick and what their family background is, what they're all about, what's important to them. I think that's probably what I've learned the most. But I think that's probably hopefully where we've changed or adapted probably the most.
How do you do that? What does that look like for you at Kenyon now when you're getting to know the kids? Is that informal conversations before and after practice? Is that sit down meetings? What does that look like?
Yeah, it's challenging for us in the recruiting process because of where we are geographically. Our demographic is national and international. So I think last time I counted, we had 11 or 12 different states. We had three different countries represented. So you just, when you're recruiting locally or regionally, you get much more time to spend with guys before you even get them on your campus. You're sitting at high school games, and honestly, you get to go know them, their friends, girlfriends, whatever. You're sitting in the stands. You hear teachers talk about them. You hear people talking about them. You just spend more time with them. Where we just don't, you know, a lot of our guys, we never see play a high school game. We don't know their high school coach as well, just because we're so far over the map. So that is really hard in terms of the vetting process on the front end. So once we get them here, I mean, I think these conversations of having guys in your office is great, but I honestly don't think that's – I think sometimes you call guys in their office and think they're in trouble. I think there's, yep. there's a problem, right. and it's a little too formal and all that. So I think, you know, even with our rules, if our guys are playing open gym, I'm allowed to, you know, there's a break. I'm allowed to at least poke my head in the gym or see them. So I'm trying to eat lunch with guys in our cafeteria, you know, I don't say every day, but every other day, breakfast, lunch, whatever. I think those help more than anything. Once the season starts, you know, those 20 minutes before practice of really just hanging out and talking with them. And I think that time on the bus is really important. I've told my assistants this all the time, and they're all young guys and they're great. And, you know, as soon as the game's over, they want to get on their phones and they're checking scores and they're on social media. And that's fine. I do a little bit of that too. But right. I think it's really a unique time. You got 3 hours with just your guys. And if you don't connect with four or five of them, I don't care how we as coaches feel, whether we lost or we're disappointed or depressed or whatever, then you got to find the time to do that later. But you've got an opportunity to sit and talk with a guy that played a lot, talk with a guy that didn't play at all, ask them how class, family, you know, if they played a lot, talk about the game, talk about whatever. But I've really tried to, you know, just sit down with guys and, you know, we got a 54 passenger bus and, you know, 16, 17 guys on whatever. There's a lot of space. So I think that is a real opportunity to talk. And before the game, it's a little bit harder on the bus ride. Guys are, you know, kind of doing their thing or you know, in a different zone. So I think that is an opportunity. But I think the informal stuff and just the casual conversations that go on like that, I think are – and the, as you know, the communication aspect, you do have to – have to text with them once in a while just to see what's up, what's going on, because that's just the day and age we live in.
How does the social media aspect affect you and your players at the Division III level? Obviously, we've seen at the Division I level that it's, you know, we've had incidents where
yep.
fans are you're getting on players and those kinds of things. And it's not, I don't think that happens quite as much at the Division III level. But obviously, there's has to be some discussion about how you use it properly and what yep. you should use it for. So how do you handle that? Because it's obviously something that you didn't have to do at the beginning of your career.
Yeah, for sure. And we don't get as much, you know, guys getting scrutinized from social media saying this kid, you know, was terrible or played a bad right. game or lost a game. Right. We don't see as much of that, but we do have to really educate them that, you know, what goes on is on there for life. And, you know, you've seen a lot with Division 1, 2, or 3 guys putting stupid stuff on there or stupid videos. You know, Halloween is coming up. That's a really, I mean, it's been Division III. There's been a lot of guys got suspended for games for doing stupid stuff. So
right.
that part of certain education process, the recruiting part has probably makes me think more than anything, because in Division III now we have, you know, guys are putting out offers, which we're not offering.
Right,
scholarships.
Right.
We're still trying to figure that out. There's people that are putting guys in uniforms. There's people that are putting guys in their locker room. There's people, you know, making graphics. How much of that do you do? How much is meaningful? How much of it is, it's just not my personality. I need to, you know, you need to be kind of in tune with what's going on in a 16, 17, 18 year old kid's mind. But we're not putting them in uniforms. We say we want you to first time put on uniform for it to be a special thing, and that's going to be on your first game. You know, we'll let them take pictures and do all that, but we're trying to focus more on the recruiting visit, their relationship, and what we can do for them, what their experience is going to be. But that's certainly something that keeps me up at night a little bit, thinking about what is genuine and what's transparent, and what's right, and at the end of the day, what's going to help you yield not the kid, but the right kid.
Right, absolutely. And you think about how confusing it is for you as an adult.
Yeah, for sure.
And then you think about how a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid is trying to navigate that. And clearly those kids they've grown up with it, so they have a lot more experience than you or I do with making sure that they're, you know, that they just use it as a means of communication. But
yeah.
yet they don't have, they don't understand the filter that goes on. As you said,
yeah.
it never goes away. And it's hard. I think about just growing up, again, thinking back to the beginning of our conversation, the era that you and I grew up in, where that stuff wasn't around and you could do stupid things and I could do stupid things.
For sure.
And nobody had a video of it.
Yep.
Nobody
nobody was going to share it with 400 other people. Maybe your friend who was sitting next to you remembers it and you could tell a funny story, but there isn't a video of these dumb things that we were doing. And kids,
Mike, you weren't doing dumb things.
I'm sure I was not doing very many dumb things, but I'm sure I did a few that if there was
you
video,
want on video.
My,
yeah.
I would not want those things to probably be out there. So
yeah. Social pressure too. You know, it's all
for sure.
Cause like I said, we said, well, we don't want a kid coming here cause we're putting a uniform on or cause we got, you know, cool graphics or something neat, but there is also something that, you know, he wants his buddies and his AAU teammates or whatever to see that, you know, he had a legit college visit and someone else thought it was important. So balancing that is a slippery slope a little bit. Tricky game.
Yeah. You got to think about what influences a kid's decision. You have to think about what is important to them. The thing that always sticks out to me, Dan, when I have this conversation about what's important to a kid is you think back to when you were playing and how important your uniform number was.
Yeah, for sure.
And that was like critical. I mean, it was, I can't think of anything that was very much more important to me heading into a season that I wanted to make sure I got my number going in. And then you think about, you know, I was coaching whatever my kids when they were in just rec basketball, where they hand you a bag of t-shirts with random numbers. And you're like, you're just passing them out to kids. Yeah. And then you see them that, you know, then they're trading, you know, because they want this number. And you forget as an adult, you're like, well, what difference does it make if you're number three or number four? Yeah. Who cares? But you forget that as a kid, those things are really, really important. And now social media just adds this whole other level because they see so much of what I get blessed to receive this offer and I got that offer and this and here's a kid in a uniform and here's a kid that I play against all the time and now I see he went and visited here and there's so many levels of, you know, it used to be that you wouldn't know any of that stuff.
None, yeah.
You would know none of it. You didn't know where anybody was going until somebody signed or until till they showed up on a campus.
Yeah, in the newspaper maybe.
Yeah, you had no idea where anybody was going to school. And now it's like not only do you find out where they're going to school, you find out about the 40 schools that they're considering going to.
Yeah.
And it's got to be overwhelming for a kid. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, we almost have to stay on social media just to try and keep up with the comings and goings a little bit. So it's, it's hard, you know, and for us too, you don't want to self-promote and do all that, but you also need to promote your program and what you're doing and all that. And that's a fine line also.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a challenge. I think it's another layer that just didn't exist 15 years ago. It just was not on anybody's radar and you could never even imagine that it was going to be, and who knows 15 years from now.
Yeah, where we're going to be, for
yeah,
sure.
what it's going to look like at that point. So after your stint at Ohio Dominican, you head out to Arkansas.
Yep.
So how do you get to Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas as a guy with Ohio ties?
Yeah. How do you get to Hendricks? How do you get to Conway, Arkansas in general? It's not the place everyone – my wife asked me that many questions. Many times, but I took the job. Where are we going and how do we get there? I had actually interviewed for the Wisconsin Platteville job where Bo Ryan was, and they were one coach removed from Bo. The football coach up there was an assistant football coach at Hanover when I was there and got me an interview, and I went up and I think I did a good job and it all went well. They ended up hiring someone that had connections to Bo. But as it turns out, that AD was friends with the AD at Hendricks. So they called and I had been at Ohio Dominican for 6 years. And I knew I wanted to be a Division III guy. And I was kind of thinking, boy, I guess I've been there 5 years. If I stay in this too long, am I going to be kind of labeled an NAI guy? Am I not going to be able to get out and get to where I want to be? And there have been some other jobs that opened. I either didn't get them or didn't think they were the right fit or the timing wasn't right. And, you know, when someone calls you, it's a little bit like recruiting, you feel wanted, then you pay attention a little bit more. So anyway, they called and I flew down there and honestly fell in love with it. Anyone who's never been to the state of Arkansas, you know, which a lot of people have, and it's beautiful. And we had a great president, a great vice president, had a great AD. And I just remember driving on campus thinking like, this is what college is supposed to look like. And I loved Ohio Dominican, but primary commuter school right in the city. And when I went down to Hendricks, I thought, boy, this the campus is beautiful. This is what it's supposed to look like. And I thought, boy, if I don't do this, am I going to be a Division III guy or an AI guy for my life? There's nothing wrong with it. But in terms of just resources, job description, money, endowment, you know, what places in Division III can do in terms of just your quality of life. So I went down there, interviewed. They were 0-23 the year before I got there. And I laugh and, you know, said discussion with my wife, but she's like, well, you know, what are we had three kids, 5, 3, and 1. We're like, what are we doing here? What are we getting into? And again, 0-23 was a tough nut to crack, but in some ways those jobs are good because the bar is set so low. And it was the same deal, third coach in 3 years, an interim guy. They had a guy that was there for 34 years before me. He was really close friend of mine, still great coach, and just was time for him to get out. And so I think from that standpoint, there were some positives to it. But again, I didn't know anything, never been in the state in my life. But again, we had really good direction, leadership. They built a new facility about 3 or 4 years in down there. Loved it. Loved the people. Loved the town. But it certainly was when I told people, you know, where I'm going. We certainly got some funny looks, and it was an adjustment. It's a different life, you know. You're in the Bible Belt there. You're in the Deep South, and me and my wife, two Midwest to Ohio Catholic kids going down there. That was a certainly different environment. But in the end, it was a good fit. But that's why I decided to do it, and I don't regret it at all. It turned out to be really, really good people that we were around.
All right, let me ask you this question about family and thinking about just all your various stops. And obviously you're married, you have kids, and we all know that coaching can be demanding, both in season, out of season, all those things that go into being a successful coach. You need to have a supportive spouse behind you, and you need to figure out a way to make sure that not only are you making time for your team, but you're also making time for your family at home. So how have you handled that over the course of your career? What's gone well for you, and maybe what have been some of the challenges in that area?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably at times good and probably at times bad. Ironically, I kind of made the move to be in small college in Division III, not to move around as much. You look at some Division I guys' resume, and it's mind-boggling. Yeah, and you wonder, some of the moves don't make sense. They're seems like lateral moves, and they're going from this to this. So anyway, I didn't think I would have to move as much. But when we were at Ohio Dominican, we never really found the right fit that was, you know, in the Midwest for us. So we've moved around more than probably we wanted. My son just graduated from college, and I remember seeing him at graduation just saying, you know, I always had these mixed feelings about having moved around so much, but end up getting at Kenyon, which ended up being a really good fit for him and everything. He said that the moving around a little bit helped him in college, and that made me feel really good, that the adjustment in terms of meeting new people and making friends and a new environment, that helped him. My other son is a freshman right now in college, and he has said the same thing. So it's certainly hard. You got this, you know, again, especially when you got young kids, that you've got to make this balance thing. At Hendricks, we played Friday and Sunday, and boy, that was really hard with young kids because you're leaving Thursday, not getting back till Sunday, you know, midnight, one in the morning. And even when you're at home, you're playing Friday, practicing Saturday, playing Sunday. That's a real challenge. So, but my wife played college volleyball. She's super competitive and understands the whole deal, but it is also an incredible mother. And also, I'm fortunate that she would say, hey, you know, listen, you need to be here for the kids, or you need to be at this at school, or you need to do this. And that kept me grounded. That was a really, really good thing for me. And I think for our kids, and, you know, I had two really, really good parents. So, but it's hard. I heard a coach talk this summer when I was at a clinic, and he said he decided, and I guess I never really thought of it this way, but he said, I decided a long time ago, they can fire me as a coach, they're never going to fire me as a husband or a dad. And I never really thought of it that way.
That's a great line.
Yeah, now he's a Division I coach now, and he's got a big check, so that it's a little bit easier. But it's a really, really good line, and I really never thought about that. But I think that's probably how I've got a little bit older, I've tried to. But it's challenging. And the challenge in Division III is there's no recruiting calendar, so you can say, hey, I can go out today, tomorrow, the next day, Saturday, Sunday, Friday, whenever. And you can do it where in Division I, I'm certain incredibly challenging and you're out for a long period of time. But there are certain times where you cannot, you know, you can't leave your campus to recruit. So making those decisions of in Division III, when do you really need to be out? And then I've always said, like, if I'm going to be out, I'm not spending a lot of time chit-chatting and BSing with other coaches. I'm going to, particularly when my kids were young, if I'm going to be out and away from my family, then I'm going to work and make the use of my time. But it's not easy for sure.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest challenges that when we talk to coaches that they face. And I think at the college level, it's a huge challenge. I think it's becoming more and more of a challenge at the high school level. Just
for
like
sure.
We talked about with Division I basketball. I mean, now you look at what the state of Ohio did this year with COVID when high school basically had unlimited contact over this summer. And I think the baseline level of what is expected of a high school coach in terms of the time commitment in the off season has grown exponentially over the last 10 to 15 years. Used to be, again, season would end and maybe you throw together some open gyms and that's about it. And
for
now
sure.
We're talking about skill development workouts every day where you could, I mean, you could seriously be in the gym 6-7 hours a day in the off season, working out players from grade school all the way up.
Yeah.
Through,
and parents are on you. If you're not doing it, parents are on
you. And there's somebody around you that is, and it's challenging. I mean, I think, you know, if you're somebody who's in your 30s and you got young kids, like that's a really, really tough job. I mean, if one thing, if you're 25 and single, or it's another thing, if you're 55 and retired, your kids are out of the house and you have that kind of time. I think if you're in that range where you're raising young kids, it becomes a really challenging thing to be able to do to kind of keep up with the Joneses that are around you. And I don't know where that's headed, but I think it's a challenge that high school coaches for sure are facing.
Oh,
out there.
I don't. Yeah. Those guys, it's in Ohio. It's, I'm sure it's that way in a lot of states, but it's really hard with the expectation. And not that they don't want to do it. Like, love being
in gym, exactly. You want access. I mean, just like we're talking about earlier with Division III, like you want to have access to your players so that you can help them improve and help them get better and build those relationships. But at the same time,
when's the point of diminishing returns? You know,
correct.
When is
Absolutely.
It not doing it? And if you're winning your games, then those decisions are easier to make. And I know I spent a lot of time trying to. You know, either my former assistants or we got a couple young head coaches in our league with families of trying to do the best I can to, I don't know if I'd say mentor them, but talk to them a little bit about, you know, I don't care if you won or you're lost. It's okay. Like you got your family and this and that, and try and keep that perspective and all that. Cause I think it's a real challenge. And I think coaches need it.
There's no question that I think that, when we look at the future of coaching, to me, that's the one thing that is the biggest challenge. I mean, obviously there's lots of other things, but I think when you just talk about keeping coaches in the profession, to me, that balance of how much time can I spend with a game that I love versus with the people that I love at home. And it's not easy to do. It's not easy to balance that because we all know how passionate you get during a season and how important it is to you. And it's easy to get caught up in the moment. And sometimes, you know, you think in the back of your mind, well, my family's always going to be there for me until unfortunately sometimes.
Yeah, they're not.
They're not because you don't see them anymore. And that's a challenge. And so anybody who's doing it successfully, I give them a lot of credit because I know it's not easy.
I never thought, I thought about this a few years ago and I had never really realized it. Between my college coach and the three head coaches I've worked for, all four of them have been divorced. Now my college coach got divorced very young, remarried to the woman for 38 years, whatever. Coach Locke got remarried. He's been married to Mindy for, I don't know, 25 years, but some of it was because of the job, because of the profession. And some of it was just, they didn't have the right balance. And I kind of had to relook and say, well, this is what I saw. And this is what I kind of learned. That's maybe not how you have to do it. And this is what the result was. And again, great guys, but that took me a little when I kind of came to that revelation. That kind of hit me in the face a little bit. But it's not going to end the job security thing. It's even in Division III, you know, high school coaches getting fired all the time. I know they still got their teaching job, but it's still hard. And
For sure.
Division three and division two guys are getting fired now too for not winning. And that's puts a added kind of press and
stress. It makes it a lot different. It makes it a lot different when you start looking at it and thinking about it. And it's obviously, you know, there's a lot of coaches that start out as assistant coaches and you have this conversation with them about, you know, you're making suggestions. And then when you come to head coach, those decisions now are yours and those decisions go on your record and your one loss. And you're the person who's being judged on what goes on and what kind of product you're putting out on the floor and what you're putting out in the classroom and all those kinds of things. And so it's a totally different pressure, especially again, as it creeps down to lower and lower levels. And you have that emphasis, if the emphasis is placed on winning and there's not more to it than that, I think that's when you get into trouble. And we've had so many conversations with coaches that clearly we all like to win. I mean, anybody who's competitive and has gotten into coaching, they've done it because winning is important to them. And yet, you know, we've talked tonight a bunch about how important the relationships are and getting to know your teammates back when you're a player and building relationships with kids and talking to them on the bus and all the things that you've already discussed and how important that stuff is. And it'd be great if everybody who was in an administrative role or in a decision-making role took those kinds of things as much into account as they do the wins and losses. I know it's never going to happen. It's completely unrealistic, but it would be great if
it would be great.
It would be great if that was the case. What do you remember about your interview when you came to Kenyon?
So I remember it was the second or third time I actually interviewed for the job. When I was an assistant at Hanover, I interviewed at least once, maybe twice. And that's actually where my relationship with Shaka Smart started. Shaka was a player and I interviewed for the job, didn't get it. And it's kind of kept the relationship going after the years and said, oh, boy, you did a great job. I wish they would have hired you and all this and that. And that's kind of how Shaka and I got this relationship going. So when I came back and interviewed after obviously being a head coach for 11 years, it was a little bit different. But just kind of, if you've ever been on our campus, which I think you have, it's pretty awe-inspiring when you walk on. So that was my thing when I came on and interviewed, just like, wow, this is a pretty amazing place. And just the national name that we have, when I told people I'm going to interview at Kenyon, it didn't matter. People in Arkansas knew about Kenyon, all over the country. So that was kind of the biggest thing for me. And the time was right for us to move back. My oldest son was in sixth grade. So if we were going to move, then the time was right. So I did feel a little bit of pressure that, boy, we need to make this happen. My father had was 80, but had passed away earlier in the year. So getting back to be able to help my mom out a little bit was certainly in the back of my mind. And my mother-in-law was battling a little bit of cancer issue too. So that part of like, boy, we need to, I had a little bit of stress and pressure that I hope this works because it's a pretty unique place. And our facility is pretty amazing just aesthetically, just to look at. So those were things that kind of stuck out to me and that the timing was right.
Absolutely. All right. I want to wrap up with one final two-part question. And that is, first of all, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as your biggest challenge as the head coach at Kenyon? And then number two, when you wake up in the morning and you think about what you get to do every day, what's your biggest joy? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
Yeah. So our biggest challenge is we haven't played basketball for 2 years,
exactly.
I hear people talking about, but literally there's only two Division III schools in our region. There's 50 schools. It's just kind of our immediate region here, and us and Oberlin, only two didn't play. So trying to figure out, what we're doing, who's gotten better, who hasn't gotten better, what are our recruiting needs. We have a freshman and sophomore class who none of them have played games. We have multiple, three kids that took gap years. They weren't even on campus at all last year. So have they gotten better? Have they worked at it? Where are they? So it's kind of an exciting deal, but certainly a challenge to restore that. And some of them just haven't been able to play a lot of 5-on-5 basketball. So I think that's a challenge, but kind of an exciting thing too, of seeing where we are and what we got and getting but getting their competitive environment back, I think is probably our biggest challenge since they haven't been in it. But when I get up in the morning, the thing that kind of gets me going is a relationship with the guys, relationship with our players and my current and former assistant coaches. Got a bunch of them out there and my former players. I've got a little bit of a commute to work. It seems I end up calling them all, one or two of them every day, just just checking in with them, seeing how they're doing. I really enjoyed that aspect of it. So that's what kind of keeps me going and trying to, you know, keep chopping wood to get us to where I want us to be and get us back to not back, but get us to the competitive level that we want to be at.
Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, whether you want to go social media, whether you want to go email, website, just share how people can connect with you. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, sure. So the email is right on our website. It's just priestd@kenyon.edu, but it's right on our website, priestd@kenyon.edu. So I am on Twitter. It's Dan Priest too, but our Kenyon basketball is pretty active on Twitter, Instagram a little bit, but not so much, but more so the Twitter thing, and more so, and I'm for better or worse, checking my email probably too much. So
completely understood. Dan, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us tonight. Had a lot of fun getting to know you, getting to know a little bit more about your program, what makes you tick. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.